Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our roundtable panel for this Wednesday, the 8th of April. It's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's a delight to have you all here and to be back. I took the day off yesterday. I had this magical day yesterday. I went.
Do tell.
Okay, I will. Thank you. I have a friend, a family member actually, who works for the Colbert Show and invited me to come down and to see one of the final Colbert shows. And so I went down, and as you may or may not know, the show ends at the end of May. There's six more weeks of programs. And they're really ramping it up for some great guests and so forth. So I went down yesterday, and the guests were Brandi Carlile, who's amazing, just stunning, did more numbers than, I mean, that could have been the show, but they only aired one of them, but others are on YouTube. And Oprah Winfrey. I got to see Oprah.
That's amazing.
Oprah-rific.
Yes.
And it was really amazing. And there was this moment where she said, "Now, what does this feel like for you to be giving this up?" And he said, "Now, don't get all Oprah on me." And then they changed places. And she sat in his seat. He sat in the guest seat. And she interviewed him. And it wasn't an interview to be funny. It was very serious and heartfelt, and it was really amazing, quite magical. And if you get a chance to watch it, it's I would recommend it. An awful lot of fun, and I'm quite sad that that show is going off the air. I'm quite sad that the franchise of The Late Show is leaving CBS. However, it was very nice to be there in one of the final shows. So then, and every time I talk about Amtrak, I seem to get in trouble with Amtrak, and Amtrak calls and gets mad at me. So I'm not saying anything mean about Amtrak. I'm just saying this.
But
the choices, no buts.
Okay.
The choices are, these are your choices. It's like a 6:30 train or a 9:30 train. So if your show gets out at 7:10 or 7.
Yep.
You can't leave till 9:30, so there you go. So that's not a complaint.
No, but aren't they adding a lot of the?
Okay. I don't know what the schedule is yet. So I went to go see Dog Day Afternoon, the play Dog Day Afternoon, based on the 1972 Sidney Lumet film, starring the one, the only Al Pacino, a gentleman by the name of John Bernthal. Is the actor from The Bear,
yep,
who plays the Sonny character in Dog Day Afternoon, and it is written by Stephen Adley Gurgis. Two things of note: one, Stephen Adley Gurgis is a UAlbany grad, so cool. Also, John Bernthal went to Skidmore, a Skiddy. So that's cool. So a lot going on there. And my dear friend and a woman I adore, Jessica Hecht, plays the harried bank teller, the senior bank teller, Colleen, and she is ever delightful. And the show did not get good reviews. I will give it a great review because loved it. I just loved it.
Despite the 9:30 train.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is the great thing about New York, where you say to yourself, "Oh, now how am I going to kill 2 hours? Oh, I'll go see a play." Like that's not bad. That's not a bad way to
kill.
Anything
be open. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be,
it's all good. So, that was a great night. Now, meanwhile, my phone was off. Mandated to me that it had to be off pretty much because of the Colbert Show and Dog Day Afternoon. It had to be off from somewhere between 4 and 9. So I knew going into the theater that a civilization could end. That I had been told. How that was all going to work itself out by the time I got out of Dog Day Afternoon, I wasn't so sure until I was in the cab going down to Penn Station. So here we are to talk about what turned out to be a ceasefire. And it is a fragile one, but we will discuss it this morning. I have one more thing I want to make an announcement about. This is a fairly major announcement for us, and it is a major announcement for us, but I wanted to just draw your attention to it because WAMC on the road, we're going back on the road. We believe, even though it snowed yesterday, we believe that winter is probably over.
Your lips and, to God's ears.
Yeah, and so we're going to start traveling again, and we're keeping the snow tires on. But still, Monday, May 4th, we are going to be broadcasting live from Frederick Church's Owana. We're going to be broadcasting from 9. We'll be doing the show there, and we'll be on site from 9 to 11. And I'll host. We're going to talk about this incredible National Historic Landmark and New York State Historic Site located in Hudson, the home and masterwork of Frederick Church, who is considered to be by many to be the greatest American landscape artist. And May 4th marks the 200th anniversary of Frederick Church's birth, and we will be celebrating that during this broadcast. So we broadcast live. Tickets are $25. That all goes to WAMC to help us, you know, stay afloat. And all you have to do is go to WAMC.org/on the road. I was just talking to my colleagues in the hall, and I said, here's the idea. We sell 10 tickets by 10 o'clock. I think we can do that. So we want to have a great audience there.
Sounds good.
It's a beautiful, beautiful place. $25, and you can see the broadcast from Hudson, New York. We have lots of cool things planned for you, and it'll be just a beautiful, beautiful day. So WAMC.org, on the road, the roundtable, live from Frederick Church's Owana on Monday, the 4th of May, beginning at 9 a.m. Doors open at 8:15. Okay. Let me introduce our group to you. Lecturer of Cognitive Sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and former Fulbright U.S. scholar to Egypt, Jackie Berry is here. Good morning, Jackie. How are you?
Good morning. I'm glad to be here. I do want to give a shout out to my alma mater, Rensselaer. I used to be a student there for a number of years. And I found out recently that we were actually noted by the Stanford University Business School as having a school that punched above its weight. We're number 14 in terms of biggest startup exits. So people that leave Rensselaer and go found startups tend to do very well. And we're ahead of Yale, and Rice is up there too. So yay, RPI. Also, in honor of it being spring, in theory.
Yes, in theory.
The forsythia in my yard is doing pretty good. Today is also National Draw a Bird Day. So I thought that was interesting.
Oh, did you have that one, Bob?
Yeah.
Did you have that one? Okay. Well, and if you get bored today, just draw a bird.
Yep.
It's better than National Flip a Bird.
That's right. Yes, and if you need help, just, you know, trace a finger. Bob Griffin is here, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at the University of Albany. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Well, I can raise your draw a bird. Today is also the National All Is Ours Day.
What is that?
It's National All Is Ours Day, where you celebrate all of the things you have. But more importantly, Joe, today is the Dog Farting Awareness Day. I kid you not, and everybody at home saying you're making this up. I'm not. I'm really not. Today is a day where you're supposed to recognize your dog's flatulence, and I thought it's apropos to where we are in society right now, and It's important.
Pardon me for stating the obvious, but for anyone who has dogs, and I'm a dog guy, I've lived my entire life with many dogs.
Yes.
Once they clear out a room, I think you're pretty aware of it.
Very much so.
I don't know. Is that a secretive thing?
No. I used to call mine the furry bagpipe. So, yeah, no, I
That may be, though, why Joe was attracted to see Dog Day Afternoon.
Could be.
Yes, that's exactly.
It's a theme, right?
That's exactly right. You've brought it all together, John. I appreciate that.
Nice.
John Faso joins us, former New York 19th Congressman, a New York Assemblyman in a past life. And there he is in the flesh. Thank you for bringing donuts once again. Always a pleasure. And it's good to see you.
Great to be here. Great to be with my fellow panelists. And it's wonderful that you're taking the show on the road to Olana, that state historic site. Mm-hmm. It's really a wonderful place.
Yep.
I was always privileged to support Olana in my time as a public official. But I would just note, Joe, that it is in the town of Greenport as opposed to Hudson.
It is in the town of Greenport. There is that. Mm-hmm. There is that,
That demarcation.
That demarcation.
But it has a Hudson post office, and it might as well be in Hudson. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But please don't write emails and yelling at Joe.
No, I know. We still... I'm waiting. I live in the town. My mailing address is the town of Greenwich. I pay school taxes to the town of Cambridge, and I live in the town of Jackson. So none of this makes sense, but that's the way these things go. Mm-hmm. And it's always confusing. But yes, thank you for thank you for making the point, because it will save us some letters. We welcome you for your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let's get started, shall we? So, you will remember yesterday that the president had been using fiery rhetoric to talk about Iran and ending a civilization, and if his needs were not met by 8 o'clock yesterday evening. Now, about 90 minutes or so prior to that deadline, a ceasefire was announced, and it is taking hold as Iran and U.S. are both claiming victory. And there's a lot to talk about here, because it seemed as if we were very close to a tumultuous situation. And then there was a great concern that seemed to be expressed. And once again, the president decided to hold off on the threats that he had continually been making. So I think initially there was a 48-hour deadline, and then we went to 5 days, and then we went to 10 days, and now we have a two-week deadline, but also a ceasefire that goes with that. Israel declared its support for the two-week truce, but said it had launched the largest wave of strikes against Hezbollah in Lebanon since the war began. That is significant, because initially we were told that the firings, the ceasefire would cover also Lebanon and Hezbollah. That does not seem to be the case. The agreement brokered by Pakistan was hailed by a victory by both sides. Mr. Trump said Wednesday that the United States would work closely with Iran after demanding Tehran's unconditional surrender for weeks. Iranian officials were triumphant, the country's first vice president saying on social media that the era of Iran has begun. After Trump failed to destroy the Islamic Republic's government, Iran said the strait would remain open while negotiations took place. Shipping companies signaled that they were cautious about resuming transit through the waterway. Two bulk carriers crossed on Wednesday. According to tracking companies, a handful of ships have been observed moving through each day since the war began. More than 400 tankers and other vessels remain effectively stranded in the Persian Gulf. Israel, which said the ceasefire did not extend to Lebanon, carried out the largest coordinated strike against Hezbollah on Wednesday since the front opened up following Hezbollah's firing of rockets and drones at Israel in solidarity with Iran in early March. Thick clouds of smoke were billowing over Beirut, the Lebanese capital, after Israeli airstrikes hit four neighborhoods in the central area of the city. Further highlighting the fragility of the truce, Iran state media reported that an oil refinery off an Iranian island in the Persian Gulf was struck at around 10 a.m. local time by unspecified quote-unquote enemies. There were no reports of casualties, according to the state-run broadcaster. Fresh Iranian attacks were also reported in some Persian Gulf countries. Kuwait's defense ministry said that its air defenses had engaged with at least 28 drones from Iran that targeted vital facilities throughout the country, despite the ceasefire. One more point I would like to make prior to handing this over to our very able team here is that the question to pose is this an off-ramp for this country, for the President of the United States, and for the Trump administration? And are we actually solving any of the causes of war from the list, a changing list of reasons for this military action? This, the president has been in full intimidation mode over the last week, certainly over the last few days. It seems to have worked, but this is a Pakistani agreement that has been agreed to by these parties, and now we see what happens. John Fassel.
Well, I think a lot remains to be seen. What is the outcome of the two-week truce, and what is the outcome in terms of the Strait of Hormuz and the passage of freedom of navigation through that strait? I think that's still an open question. I think it also is likely that Iran's military and defense industrial capacity has been seriously degraded. How long it will take them to reconstitute that, I think it's going to take some time. Obviously, China was very instrumental in helping them resuscitate their ballistic missile capacity after the June U.S.-Israeli attacks from June of 25. But I think the other thing to think about in terms of the long term is that Iran's efforts in recent years to surround Israel with proxies like Hezbollah, like Hamas, like the Houthis, and other groups has been seriously disrupted. Israel showed a great capacity to decapitate Hamas's leadership when they took out one of their senior commanders in a safe house in Tehran last year. But also, the Iranian attacks on the Gulf states have, I think, seriously changed the dynamic of those states towards Iran. And much of the Iranian efforts back to the 2023 Hamas attack on Israel were intended, I believe, to disrupt the progress towards which the Abraham Accords have brought about. And now you have the Gulf states, which had always been somewhat more reticent about confronting Iran, now in basic confrontation with them. So I think that we will see. I think there's much that has to be seen over the next few weeks and months in terms of what actually happens with the strait. I think President Trump's language involved in the lead up over the last week or so was pretty irresponsible and reckless and frankly indefensible. But I do think that the deck in the Middle East is fundamentally reshuffled over the last couple of years, but particularly since the Hamas attacks in 23. And we'll see where this goes in terms of the Iranian regime.
Pete Hegseth this morning said that the U.S. had won the war with Iran and had largely destroyed its military. And though CNN has been reporting that U.S. intelligence assessed that Iran maintains significant missile launching capability, the president went after that report on Truth Social last night.
Well, we know they maintained some because they were able to, even though we had 13,000 or so sorties, they were able to take down that F-15 and the A-10. But taking down two planes out of 13,000 sorties does not show a robust air defense system.
So, Bob Griffin, we went from 8:06 a.m. yesterday with the president saying that a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. And then 10 hours and 26 minutes later, he lifted the threat and said that an intervention by the Pakistani government had led to a two-week ceasefire. We were asking all along there were so many accounts yesterday as to, well, who's talking to who and what are they talking about? And we still really don't have those answers fully.
No, Joe. And John, thank you for the comments. I agree with you. I also think that the language that was being used was both deeply disturbing and irresponsible. I concur with your summation there. So thank you for that. Joe, I still don't know why we're.
So this is what it takes to piss off the Pope, by the way.
Yes. who agreeing with John? Or,
No. Well, maybe on another issue. I don't know. That's between John and the Pontiff. I don't know. But the back and forth between the language that the president had been using is certainly something that the Pope has been keyed in on ever since all of Holy Week and up until yesterday, prior to the ceasefire, once again calling it irresponsible.
Yeah, and sort of where I'm at on this situation, my feeling is that any time we can have a ceasefire and de-escalate is good. So the idea that we're doing anything that we can to try to negotiate, but also ensure the safety of our service members and civilians involved. So that in itself is positive. I think there are elements of the 10-point platform that are completely untenable. So Iran's position, because both sides right now are declaring absolute victory. I don't know what absolute victory looks like because, I don't understand what the objectives were going into this. But what Iran's position is that they're looking for release of all sanctions, withdrawal of all U.S. forces from the Middle East, release of all frozen assets, acceptance of nuclear enrichment, which honestly, I don't see how we could negotiate negotiate on some of these positions. Now, this may be just posturing, and what comes out at the end is something very different. I know that as of now, you know, we've spent over $40 billion on the war effort. You know, 300 plus wounded. I'm unclear on the number of casualties. I'm looking at oil prices, and it's also the other element that I think affects the Middle East is the U.S. bases and the damage that occurred at our U.S. bases. I've said multiple times on other shows, what it shows to me, though, is that as far as our military, we have got to go back to the drawing board and rethink what our military posture is going to be vis-a-vis a lot of these new and evolving technologies like drone technologies. And John, I think you're absolutely correct that the hands of both China and Russia are deeply involved in supporting the regime in Iran. I fear that the regime is actually, while there's a lot of talk about the, quote, decapitation of the leadership, I fear that the regime is actually in stronger control in Iran today than it was a month ago. So I do worry that I do worry about how fragile the ceasefire is. I will note, and I concur with a couple of things I read this morning that some of the continued fighting could be attributed to the fact that Iran as a strategy sort of decentralized to their command structure and the word still hasn't gotten out, which is not unusual for ceasefires. I'll also note in a concern that I had that I haven't been able to confirm this is that the Iranian military is now saying that they are going to control the shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. So I'm not exactly sure how that opens the strait if they're going to control it and what that means. So a lot of questions, a lot of unknowns. A ceasefire to me is still, I think, really, really important. And then we can talk about what we think some of the objectives are.
Jackie?
Thank goodness. I was very relieved when this ceasefire was announced. I felt like we were at a real inflection point when the airman was shot down, praying that we found him first. I agree with all of your comments and support everything that you said. I also agree that I don't know exactly what victory could be defined as, but if it is a victory, from my perspective as an American citizen, it seems like it maybe is a Pyrrhic victory in a battle we didn't even need to fight. So, to be clear, Iran is a bad actor. They've done some heinous things. They are a bad actor, full stop. But, you know, what I mean by Pyrrhic victory is it's been such a roller coaster for the last 4 to 6 weeks. I don't know how we get through the next 32 months of this presidency with our credibility intact. I'm thinking about our allies and how we have alienated them and isolated ourselves. We've been very rude to the British Prime Minister. Some of the things that have been said, it even turned into a skit on Saturday Night Live. Comments were made about Macron's wife and, you know, some personal things about their relationship. We threatened Denmark and, you know, just completely alienated them. And then as far as the American people go, gas and food prices are not going to just magically go back to where they were. I'm sure there are people right now, unfortunately, reconsidering their summer travel plans, right? You know, they can't afford to load up the RV and go see Aunt Susie or whatever they were planning to do because they can no longer afford to, and that's not going to get fixed overnight. So, and then also, you know, his base, right? He's alienated his base who no longer believes him when he said that he was the peace president. And that has been, you know, he's been the complete opposite of that. And then also, I feel like the people of Iran are never going to trust us again. And to the point that you just made, we've only made the regime stronger because that's what happens in times of war. People become more nationalist and they rally around the current government. But it went from, oh, you know, we're going to help you achieve regime change to we're going to taking from the press conference that happened last week, bomb you back to the Stone Ages, quote, where you belong, unquote. I mean, that is just... it's borderline racist, in fact, in my view, to even say, like, Stone Ages, why do they belong there? Why are you saying that? One minute it was, we're going to help you. And the next minute is, you belong in the Stone Ages and we're going to put you back there. So Iran is no longer, the people are never going to trust us again. And so I just, you know, I'll say one more thing. And I didn't I don't know the full details of the ceasefire, and I hope it lasts longer than 2 weeks. I didn't see anything about not attacking the allies that we have, the Gulf nations that are there, that are neighbors. I don't even know that's a part of the deal, so I don't know that he cares about that per se. But from my perspective, just the past 6 weeks, so many lines were crossed. How do you come back from profanity-laden posts? How do you come back from, you know, waffling around deadlines and threatening to bomb civilizations out of existence? I mean, just decorum is completely out of the window. And we have another 32 months of this, having alienated the people at home, the people abroad, the people in Iran who we were supposedly fighting for. And gas prices are high because we reopened the strait, which was already opened before we went there. So just, you know, it feels like a Pyrrhic victory to me.
I find it fascinating. Again, I wasn't here yesterday, but so I didn't get to talk about it, but I know we talked about it on the air. And that is the press conference on Monday where the president was talking about the saving of the finding of the airman who was missing and being rescued, which is an amazing story, then waved off questions about a ceasefire. But in moments where I'm sorry, I can't come up with a better term than unhinged, was his remark that the Iranian people want the U.S. to keep bombing, and they're pleading with the United States to keep bombing them. And we saw very much the opposite of that in the wee hours of this morning on our time frame, where Iranians had taken to the street, thankful that the bombing had finally ceased, at least for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, the language, again, and language matters, whether we like it or not, and part of the power of the United States was that the president spoke for more than just the United States in the past, and I think that that is something that we have squandered. John, can I ask you a question? If you were still in Congress, what advice would you be giving to the speaker? Like, where do you see, you know, I've been very critical about the lack of checks and balances. I started to see comments from people, even like Ron Johnson, who has been a staunch Trump supporter, coming out questioning some of the language yesterday. What's going on there? And if you were in Congress right now, what actions would you like to see the leadership taking?
Well, I think, Bob, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure I have a full answer. I would say that the major area where I find fault with how the administration has handled this is the way they've not explained this to the American people, the way they have not laid out, number one, Iran can never have a nuclear weapon. Number two, Iran represents a critical threat to American interests and the interests of our allies and peace and security in that region, that for over 40 years they have conducted themselves in a policy which is hostile to the United States overwhelmingly. I mean, they routinely pronounce death to America. And I don't think that this was clearly articulated, because the American people do not follow the nuance of foreign policy on a day-to-day basis. And this is now this was launched, and it was not effectively explained. I candidly would let Marco Rubio do the talking and explain this, because he does it a heck of a lot more cogently than any other administration spokesman, including the president. But I think that it's important to see this in the context of. So that's, Bob, that's what I would say. You have to better explain this to the American people. But it's important to see this in the context of what's happening in the Middle East. And the major development over the last few years has been the Abraham Accords and the bringing of relations between the Gulf states and the Israelis closer together, mm-hmm. commercial, economic, scientific, etc. And the reason Hamas attacked at the moment they did, and the reason why Iran's proxies reacted once those attacks took place, was that they wanted to derail the prospect of the Saudis and the Israelis having a regional dialogue and being part of those Abraham Accords. That's what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And so we have simply not laid out the case, I think, effectively to the American people as to what our interests are, what is the overriding goal of the United States in that region, what are the goals of our partners and allies in that region, and how Iran is the entity that stands against those things. And also note as well that it's China and Russia that are the main sustainers of the Iranians. I would also note, and we haven't discussed this yet, Pakistan is very close to China.
Yep.
And we can't eliminate that part of this equation in these discussions. And so it'll be very interesting over the next few weeks to follow that.
So I would like to, when we come back, ask you the question, ask the panel the question of how they became the brokers of this, because I find that to be a fascinating aspect. We'll take a break. We'll continue on the other side. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Yes, we're getting all of your letters. We have a lot of them. We're getting them, and we'll read them, I promise you. But first, we're going to take this short break. Some great jazz music this morning performed by Flea.
Flea
from Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Interesting.
Yeah. How cool is that?
Yeah.
New album out, and we'll be hearing that music throughout the morning. Good stuff. Very, very interesting. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. John, right before the break, you asked a very good question that I wanted to bring to the fore, and that is that this, and I mentioned it a couple times, but this is a Pakistani-led effort. How did we get to that point? And without sounding overly offhanded, it does seem that the Pakistan wouldn't necessarily be the one you would expect to be the mediator of such a such an important agreement.
Well they're obviously an Islamic country. They border Iran, so it's easy to get to Islamabad from Tehran. And what's the alternative? Is it Egypt? Probably not. Don't have the weight in the area, and they're closely connected to Israel. It's not Turkey. They're a member of NATO. So I think really it when you go through the list of alternatives, certainly it's not Bahrain and the Gulf states that have previous and the UAE, which had now been attacked by Iran, and which previously were often the interlocutor between the U.S. and Iran. So I think that's how it wound up being Pakistan. But the note I would make is their connection to China. They're very closely related militarily and economically to China. And so that is also a part of it. And maybe that's one of the reasons why the Chinese backdoor encouraging Pakistan to step forward, because the Chinese have real interests in the outcome of the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, and in many respects, that China's oil is more dependent on Hormuz than the United States.
Well, we're not dependent.
Not at all. I mean, yeah. which is also part of the sort of huge question mark of like, okay, what were our objectives going in? The other element, John, that you put your finger on, you got to remember, we've got the whole Sunni Shiite schism in the Middle East about which flavor of Islam, and that's where and Sir Jennifer, you can speak to this in much greater detail than I can. This is where I always think of Saudi Arabia the Saudis and the Egyptians, and you know, sort of as a counterbalance to Iran and Pakistan. The other element, Joe, that I'll toss – two other elements I'll toss in because this isn't a complex enough situation at its face anyway. A, you also have rising tension in recent military conflicts at the border between India and Pakistan, which is also part of the ongoing tension between India and China. So when we talk about seeds of a potential world war – that's where some of these concerns come from, is that there's so many players with so many different reasons why they hate each other that it becomes wrapped into bad political decisions backed by military can certainly escalate. The other element that I'll toss on the table we can come back to is the concerns that I have about what's going on with the lack of shipping through Hormuz and what it means for the fertilizer industry, particularly as we come into seasonal plantings. But do you want to talk a little bit about the given your experiences?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I was going to say Pakistan does have a lot to lose if there is disruption in the cables that are at the bottom of the Strait of Hormuz, in the sense that something like 80 to 90% of their internet traffic proceeds through there, where it's much less for India and for some other places. There was one thing that I wanted to circle back to before we talk about the fertilizer. So someone said on a previous panel, and maybe it was you, Joe, words mean things, quoting Rush Limbaugh, words mean things, and you can't just say words.
Right.
But you were talking about, you know, and giving advice in terms of clearly articulating, not words means things, too. So when you don't use the words that you need to use to talk to, you know, American people and to your allies, that the absence, the vacuum there is just as meaningful. So I just
Jackie, you're absolutely correct, and that's one of the things that I've found just observing this, you know, from a certain distance now, so disquieting about it, because the administration has just simply not laid out clearly what our interests are, how the Iranians cannot, other than saying they cannot have a nuclear weapon, successive administrations have said. The thing about the Trump policy is that they were trying to negotiate with the Iranians. They had numerous negotiations with them. And I remember Steve Witkoff saying that in one of their last meeting that the Iranians said, well, we have enough to make 9 nuclear bombs. And that was a pivotal point in the mindset of the administration, that the Iranians are just jerking us around. They're just leading us along. And they've led along successive administrations. Indeed, if the Obama JPOA agreement had been in effect, they would now have the bomb. Because the timing of that agreement would have expired and they would have been able to create a bomb. So I think, but it simply has not been clearly articulated to the American people the threat that Iran poses to the region and to us. And when we saw that they had previously said they didn't have a ballistic missile that could carry more than 2,000 miles, and then they send ballistic missiles, two of them, at the Indian Ocean outpost of Diego Garcia, which is over 2,500 miles away from Iran, you can't trust anything they've said. And that's, but again, these things have not been clearly laid out in a sober, concise fashion for the American people. And I think that's the biggest flaw in this entire thing in terms of, but you're right, what you say, it means something, and what you don't say means something.
So we have about 2 minutes, but we'll come back to it after the break. But about fertilizer and prices, obviously we are seeing the stock market surge this morning. We are seeing oil prices go down significantly. Interestingly, fertilizer prices are still soaring. This is still an issue. This war has sent fertilizer prices going up 50%. This is a threat to the global food supply. And that is a case that seems to be often an afterthought as to what it is that we're talking about here.
Yeah, and it concerns me because you know, say everything holds, oil prices will come down, but oil prices, they have a tendency to come down a lot slower than they go up. And when you're talking about what could potentially be a new normal as a national cost of oil and including diesel, you start to get into shipping costs. But when you start to get into shipping costs, the food prices are going to go up. But when you also are dealing with increased prices for farmers to produce, and frankly, there are windows. I mean, it's not like, you know, if you don't have the fertilizer now, you're going to miss parts of the season. So I think that there's the potential for some really rocky economic times ahead of us, and I think it's something that we just need to keep an eye on.
And that's because of the natural gas that's in the Gulf. They have been able to use natural gas to create urea, which is necessary as a fertilizer, and it's used worldwide. One of the things I would be saying also to the administration right now, if I were still in Congress, eliminate the tariffs on fertilizers from Canada, because that really is an impediment as well. But Bob is right. You don't turn these things on and off with a switch. It takes time to ramp up, to have the production, and to ship it.
Jackie, real quick.
I was just going to say, I live in an area where there's a lot of farms, Dutchess County, and you know, I'm surrounded by farms, and this is the time when people are planning, and you get those smells, and I mean, you're just going to see it happen. That
yes, you get those smells,
and the price of diesels around the tractors is just going to go up so much. Yeah, I just was going to comment on just sympathizing with my neighbors. Who, you know, at this point are really just wanting to have a good season and are starting to feel the economic crunch.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll include your letters and we'll obviously add more aspects to this story as we go on in our second hour. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. First, we take a break and then news with Roy Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 8th of April. It is 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. We have a great group this morning. Jackie Berry is here, lecturer of cognitive sciences at RPI and former Fulbright U.S. scholar to Egypt. Former New York 19th Congressman and former New York Assemblyman John Faso joins us. And Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin.
I'm just eye candy today, which is horrible for a radio show, but that's
We were talking during the break. I just wanted to bring it up real quick, but we were talking during the break. The severity, the importance of all that has been happening, and sometimes there are just these little things that also happen, and it's surprising that they bury their way into your consciousness, even though there are things of far more import that are there. But as the Easter egg, the White House Easter event, they have the Easter egg event. And the children on the lawn of the White House, and the president is there, the first lady is there, and somebody in a bunny suit. And so the president was signing things for the kids, and then starts talking to the children, telling them a delightful story about how his predecessor used an auto pen, and that Joe Biden, that had they come when Joe Biden was there, he was incapable of signing his own name and relied on a machine to sign documents on his behalf. The children looked at him in bewilderment, as I think many did. But that was moments just a little bit before the continued threats to Iran took place just after that event on the White House lawn, as children had to process not only perhaps a civilization going away, but why the previous president would have needed a machine to sign his name.
That gets to what Jackie had said. Sometimes things are best left unsaid.
Yeah. This is somewhat personal for me. I mean, although I've been in New York for many years, I'm a native of Washington, D.C., and I actually grew up going to the White House and doing the Easter egg hunts. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun when I was a kid. But I guess my concern, kind of zooming out from that particular event, which is a head scratcher, needless to say, is the impact that having a president who uses the rhetoric that he uses and the posturing towards allies, friends, people at home, basically anybody, on young people as a whole, right? So just, you know, kind of zooming out. So we've been very critical of, you know, sports stars or anyone that does anything that kind of falls off the rails. Don't you know you're a role model and people are looking up to you and you're supposed to behave in a way that young people can appreciate? But, you know, here's an interesting statistic. Apparently, in 2017, a study was conducted that found that in districts where the vote primarily went to Trump, bullying was up 18% than in districts where the vote had gone for Hillary Clinton. So it's actually increasing how children deal with one another in a bullying fashion. And I'm saying this to say that because we are all processing this from the lens of adults who have had prior administrations and prior world leaders and prior people to look to understand what appropriate behavior is, appropriate words are, appropriate ways to deal with people. Children don't have the same perspective. You know, another more personal example, my son was born the year before President Obama was elected. So from the time he was born until he was 8 years old, we had a black president. And so from his perspective, that's perfectly normal. Whereas from those of us who, you know, kind of saw the trajectory of that and Jesse Jackson, who recently passed away, he, you know, when he ran in the 80s, it was just not realistic that he was actually going to win. And we knew that was unrealistic. And then there was that moment, the 20 years later, when Obama was elected and he's standing there and there's tears in his eyes. And, you know, they do the close up on his face and you can see that he's crying. And then later on, they asked him, you know, why were you crying when Obama was elected? And he said, I was just thinking about Martin. I was just thinking about Martin. I was thinking about how far this country has come and wishing that he could see it. And, you know, he got to live to see that. And that was great. So but my son being 18 years old, well, of course, you would have a black president. Like, why is that a strange thing? I don't want young people, whether they're my students or even my children or my children's children at some point, to think that this is the type of behavior that government officials, their brains are not finished forming yet. So they don't have the perspective to be able to put this in context and understand this is not good behavior. And not only did bullying go up, but bullying against racial groups, bullying against religious groups, ethnic bullying just went up drastically after he came into office. So I just thought that was important to mention.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I would note that I'm now seeing public figures on the right and the left increasingly using vulgarities or expressions that in an earlier day would have been roundly criticized for doing. But now a number of people think, well, this shows that I'm legitimately fighting for their concerns because I can go out and use coarse language in order to transmit a message. And I think it's wrong. I mean, I always say my model for certainly on the Republican side was Ronald Reagan in terms of how he conducted himself and the way he explained things and the decorum in which he held himself. And I think it's really important that for the American people, and particularly, as Jackie says, for young people to see those examples. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, maybe we're all talking in the wind here, but I would hope we would go back to a better way of conducting ourselves in public.
Maybe we can institute a swear jar using the money to rebuild a normal East Wing of the White House. Like funny. Well, let's do it. Why not?
But I mean, you know, we sort of chuckle, but at the same time, I listen to the president. I read his tweets. I would be remiss if I thought his tweets on Easter were insulting to multiple different religions.
Like how many? It was amazing how you can insult that many people that quickly.
It truly is, Joe. But it's also, I like many others are questioning his mental capacity right now. And that is absolutely terrifying. And I think part of what scared me about his comments about wiping out a civilization is that I no longer trust that there are people around him who have the better angels. That at least under Trump won, I had faith in Tillis. I had faith in Mattis, who's Secretary of Defense. I had faith in John Kelly, who is the Chief of Staff. I don't have faith in where this cabinet is. I mean, think about Hezges' comments.
And Kane, right?
And Kane's. But think about the comments that the Secretary of Defense made within the last hour and a half, where he said that Iran begged. Okay, I'm sorry. If we're going to be negotiating for peace, language that emasculates and demeans is not the best negotiating position. And there's a lot wrong with Trump, but there's a lot wrong with the people that he surrounded himself with as well. I mean, this isn't just a Trump issue. This is, I think it's his propaganda team, but I think it's members of his cabinet. And John, you know, one of the things I was just thinking your comment triggered to me is that there was a time when even if you disagreed at the State of the Union, okay, there was a level of decorum that was expected from the body that led to a certain feeling that I had that we were still a country. Okay, you could disagree, but it wasn't coarse. It wasn't vulgar. And now when I look at the outbursts and the fact that it's become a game of who can shout shout the loudest and who can heckle the president, and that's starting to permeate through all of society, and it's not good for us.
Because I see this as a lawyer. When political figures attack judges because they disagree with a decision, judges can't speak in public to defend themselves. They can only use their opinions and their writing in order to explain their views. And I think it's you see this again. You see this on both sides where there are attacks on judges. And we've seen Chief Justice Roberts, I think, noted not long ago about the number of threats that federal members of the federal judiciary have received, district court judges, appellate judges, Supreme Court justices, et cetera. And it's all part and parcel of what Jackie was saying in terms of how we've allowed the discourse. I mean, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a great senator, and I was privileged to know and work with him on a number of things, and he had a term, defining deviancy down. And we certainly are taking that to new depths, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the same people who, ripped Tiger Woods for being imperfect and having his falling are the same people that are like, oh, well, that's how he expresses his authenticity. And, that's how we know that we have, and it's just so that to me seems hypocritical if we can hold just a normal guy who plays a sport really, really well compared to the president of the United States to a different standard. And to my knowledge, none of those people have used profanity in a public forum, right? They have done things in private. They maybe have not been bad for their reputations and for their relationships and their marriages. But, they have not done things during wartime, to an enemy. They have not said things that are just, completely just it goes back to the issue of decorum.
All right, let's go to the letters. We have many, so we begin. And start with Lynn. Please refresh my memory. When was the last time that Israel honored a ceasefire?
Well, the Israelis are in a hostile neighborhood and they're defending themselves. And there have been multiple times over the years where, in fact, you go back to the Camp David and Yasser Arafat, and the former Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Iban famously once said that the Palestinians or the Arabs never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And they had great opportunities to win a Palestinian state 25 years ago, and they rejected it. And so I do think that Israel was violently attacked. What's shocking to me is the number of people that have immediately after they were attacked by Hamas went out on the streets and started justifying what the Palestinians, what Hamas had done, which I don't think really represent the true feelings of many Palestinians.
Let's go to another letter. And again, we welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We check in with Andrew. Just a quick reminder that the cost of the Iran war is currently $44 billion. That's over $120 per U.S. resident or $14 million per U.S. county. It's a good thing we don't need roads, fire stations, hospitals, child care, health care, and can afford to literally burn money to blow things up and kill innocent people. Looking forward to the conservative spin on why this is a quote-unquote win.
National defense is a heck of a lot cheaper than a nuclear-armed Iran.
Anne writes to us and says, I knew he would back down from his genocidal threat. I think he was made to back down. But beyond that, I think it is worth looking into all his threats and backing off and its effect on the market and oil. My guess is someone is making big bucks off of all of this seesawing.
I have so many questions about some of the stock dealings and some of the futures dealings and There's a lot of ugly here. I'm struggling, Joe, with the amount of money that we do put into national security vis-a-vis money back into our own country. And I was upset with the president's comments about we don't have enough money for Medicaid or Medicare, and it should be the state's responsibility, and they should raise taxes. I think there needs to be a much more robust question about what level of services we have, and frankly, who's paying for them. So I do look forward to the midterms. I think it's going to be an interesting picture into where the American people feel the government is heading.
We go to this letter from Ricky. Peace in West Asia will only happen if Israel stops its expansionist ideas. They are the only country in the region continually attacking their neighbors and dragging the U.S. into an illegal war. Iran will continue to resist colonialism in West Asia based on their revolutionary ideology.
I absolutely disagree with this letter writer. I think you are putting Iran and their regime on a moral pedestal that is absolutely undeserving and ignores the history of what they've done. And I would urge you to go back. Read the history about the Iraqi-Iranian war. Mm-hmm. Look at the use of terrorism, global terrorism. This is part of the problem. Is that you want to make this a black and white situation? Clearly evil versus good. You can't with this regime. Okay, this regime is not a good regime. So no, I disagree with this letter writer strongly that Iran is somehow a beacon of good governance and morality. It's not.
Anyone else on that?
Here, ditto.
Okay, we'll take a ditto. Now let's go to this letter from Carl. Trump's comments about wiping out a civilization, committing genocide in Iran, cast a stain on all of us in the eyes of the world. Jackie, you had mentioned this. Mm-hmm. As a country, we are all responsible for what the USA does. Then we go to this from Brian. How can you talk about the events of the last few years in the Middle East without keeping front and center the massacre of more than 70,000 Gazans with 170,000 more injured, including thousands of children literally losing limbs, et cetera, with no resolution of the Palestinian issue, not to mention the ravings and crimes of Netanyahu and the settlers of the West Bank?
I think I'll go for Bob's comment before this. I mean, it just Hamas part of the ring of steel that the Iranians tried to put around Israel with Hezbollah in Lebanon and their sympathizers in Syria, aided by the Russians, by the way. Then you look at what Hamas has done, the Houthis, the others. I mean, Israel is not attacking its neighbors. Israel is a democracy, flawed though they may be at times, like we are flawed. But the kind of overwhelming comments that I hear of this nature really are disturbing because it doesn't show a balanced and historical view of what's gone on in that region for the last 70 years. And I just lament that people adopt this point of view that's so anti-Israel, and I think they truly believe from the river to the sea. I mean, they would like to wipe out the state of Israel, as some radicals on the other side would like to see, and to put it all on Israel, especially after the October 23 attacks, I think is absurd.
And I don't disagree with a lot of what you said, though, John. I do feel like Israel has gone too far in what they've done in Gaza. And there's no, and again, like this whole situation in Iran, what's the plan? Okay, what I mean, you put your finger on something that's really bothered me is that I thought there was an opportunity a couple decades ago to look at a true two-state solution. Would it be a perfect solution? No, but at least I thought there was a potential path forward. And even as recently as a decade and a half ago, when we're still doing a lot of work for the government with folks in Israel, there was still an optimism about an opportunity for a two-state solution. I just don't know. I mean, now it just seems to be even worse, and I don't know how we get out of that. And this is where the continued cycle of violence is going to continue. I'm not even sure anymore how to break that.
Well, the Abraham Accords were one way to break it because I think Israelis and the Gulf states started to say, hey, we're not getting anywhere in terms of this ceaseless conflict that's going on over the Palestinians. And they basically wanted to turn the page. And the Iranians and others wanted to not allow that to happen. So I think genuine peace in that region is possible, especially when you look at the capabilities that exist in those countries and the technology and the economic advancements in Israel and the what you see going on in the Gulf and their development. It's entirely contrary to this kind of beggar-your-neighbor approach that the Iranians have pursued. Time will tell whether or not the Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, is open to free navigation. And I'm thankful that we have a ceasefire. I hope it lasts. But Iran is the bad guy in this entire region.
Jackie, anything you want to add?
Nothing to add.
Okay, let's go back to the letters we have before us, and we'll just get one or two in here before we have to take a break. David said it's a bit nauseating listening to the panel this morning. Not nearly enough anger and sadness is being expressed. Billions lost, lives lost, infrastructure destroyed, historical loss, the entire world affected, all on a whim, which will linger for years. And the letter goes on. I will say I think there's still a lot to process here, right? There's still a lot we don't know.
Correct.
A lot to be seen as it comes.
Yeah, and I appreciate it, but don't read my comments into the depth of my emotions. I am really, really unhappy with where this country is heading right now. I'm really, really unhappy with where we as a people are, with how callous we are allowing ourselves to be towards our neighbors, both in on the international stage, but also here at home. I don't like the fact that things like basic human rights, like healthcare and education and infrastructure are impacted. So, no, I'm not happy.
Yeah.
Please never, never underestimate Bob's bitterness. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable for this Thursday edition, Wednesday edition of, there you
Thursday.
Go, Wednesday edition of the roundtable, April 8th, 1034, and 90.3 on your radio dial unless you live elsewhere. All right, let's go to more letters, and as we try to make more, try to figure out what's going on here and get the mood of the people. Diane writes, Woodcoff and Kushner have no diplomatic background. Negotiating real estate is one thing. Negotiating people's lives, theirs, and the world's, totally different. Plus, there has been reported in the New York Times that Kushner is negotiating side monetary deals for his investment fund. Everything with this group is a one-and-done issue, and you can't do that not understanding history, relationships, and how they approach their lives. Bobby, you were making this point earlier of the some of the financial advantages that are coming with these negotiations.
Yeah, and you know, John, earlier you said something I thought was very poignant. And where is Marco Rubio in this situation? Because if you're right, if I was going to have a spokesperson for this whole thing, who could I think speak more plainly, and certainly I think bring a level of comfort to members of Congress, it would have been Rubio, and he seems to be missing. Do any insights into is he on the way out, or is he just? I mean,
no, I don't think he's on the way out at all. But I do agree that with your comment, and I think the administration would be wise to have him do more of their talking for him.
I was surprised when, as all of this is just being just emerging over the last 12 hours, that when there apparently are going to be talks in Islamabad on Friday that the Pakistanis have set up, and I believe J.D. Vance is going to be representing the United States as well as Woodcoff and Kushner, but again, surprised that that would not include the Secretary of State. Whatever that's worth. We go to Robert. How is there any more crucial topic than Trump's insanity? What he has done and said must not become normalized. John continues to be unable to seriously criticize this president, who is clearly unfit for any public office. Trump must be removed from power, but the Republicans will not do it. Unconscionable behavior from these legislators. I think you've been fairly serious in your criticism this morning, but
I guess people hear what they want to hear.
Maybe so. Frank, first, thank goodness for this pause for the Iranian people. However, this question is how this will be viewed by Trump supporters. Is this a win for him, and will the credit go to him directly for the outrageous statements that he made? Will that be a sign of quote-unquote strength for him rather than the psychopathic bombast that it really is? Given the very short-term memory loss, MAGA supporters, did the profane talk work on his base? I hate to think of this ceasefire as a win for Trump in a war that he created in the first place. I believe that quote-unquote little fact will be put aside. While the two-week pause goes on, the prices still will be going up. Epstein Trump file still not revealed. Food prices getting more outrageous. Voting rights still under attack. I am not feeling very optimistic, says Frank. Jay, some key points to remember. The strait was open before the war. The world economy was okay before the war. Iran was sanctioned. Now, we've caused a lot of unnecessary problems to reopen the strait, rebound the world economy, and best of all, we lifted sanctions on Iran. So who exactly won? That from Jay.
Iran cannot be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. That regime cannot have a nuclear weapon. And I think that's really what the letter writer misses. Would he be content to have Iran with a nuclear weapon? Would he think that would add to peace and security in the region and the world for Iran to have a nuclear weapon? I think that is the question. Four successive administrations, Democrat and Republican, have tried to negotiate and talk to Iran about their nuclear program, which is not for peaceful purposes. It is strictly for military and offensive purposes. And the Iranian behavior in arming its proxies in that region, doing things like bombing a synagogue in Buenos Aires 25 or 30 years ago, and numerous acts of terrorism that they have sponsored throughout the world, leads me to believe, and not just this administration, but the prior administrations, both Democrat and Republican, have said Iran cannot be permitted to have a nuclear weapon. That is the bottom line.
But I also think this is part of the challenge for that we face is a bombing campaign isn't going to destroy the ambitions of the Iranian regime to have a nuclear weapon. I think the other part of the unstated elements of your comments, John, that we should put on the table is that part of the concern from multiple presidents, okay, including Obama and Biden and Bush, is that a nuclear capacity in the hands of the Iranian regime would be a weapon that would most likely be used rather than just a deterrent, which is also one of the reasons why I was so deeply offended about the comment from our president about wiping out a civilization, because it's exactly the crap that I would hear and expect from the Iranian regime, and we are a better people than that.
And that kind of comment gives them a degree of moral suasion where they can say, see, this is why we have to have it.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it was entirely counterproductive to U.S. aims, that statement, and very destructive to our policy and our reputation. That being said, I still come back to the bottom line, which is the reason why the U.S. made these attacks was after four administrations' fruitless efforts getting played by the Iranians, never being willing to really come to a truthful resolution of the issue. It is not for commercial or other economic prosperity reasons that they were pursuing this ambition. They were pursuing this for offensive military capacity. And their history of this regime over 45 years can lead you to know that's an inescapable conclusion, in my view.
It still raises question, though, that I understand what you're saying, and I understand the history. You can look at the use of chemical weapons, by the Iranian regime. My concern still, though, is the planning that went into it. The idea that we could bomb our way out of it. That this could be sort of a neat just air war that would resolve this. I think is faulty, and I certainly am not prepared to put ground troops. I think that would be absolutely horrible. So I still don't know what the answer is, but I don't think that we've achieved our goals because I don't trust their regime.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you that a bombing campaign by itself is probably not going to be enough. But this campaign, I think, will have deflected and deferred their ambitions for a considerable period of time now. And that is certainly my hope, and I think that should be the hope of our nation and other nations that want to have peace and stability in that region. And hopefully there will be something that internally causes the regime to fall. It's not there yet, to be sure.
I just want to say I completely agree with you, Bob, as far as not trusting the regime. One of the reasons I was praying so hard that we find the airmen first was because we know what happens if he goes into their hands first. Mm-hmm. And there are probably plenty of Americans who may not be old enough to remember some of the things that happens when people fall into their hands, but it just would get really ugly really quickly. And at that point, it's difficult for us to find an off-ramp and to just get out of it. I know we have to go to break.
We do have to go to a break, but we'll be back, and we have more time to talk. John Faso, thank you very much for being with us. It's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. John has to bounce, as the kids say.
Thank you very much.
You are very welcome. Thank you very much. We will continue with Bob Griffin and Jackie Berry and your letters after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Jackie Berry and Bob Griffin with us. They are the remains, the remainders of the Islanders. And it's good to have you both here. Thank you very much. Let's change subjects slightly. Not really, but slightly. For decades, the U.S. government has helped poor Americans pay their home heating and cooling bills. It sends money to states which then administer the aid, assisting nearly 6 million households nationally. With a roughly $4 billion budget, the bipartisan program known as LIHEAP is just a sliver of a sprawling federal balance sheet that ranges well into the trillions of dollars each year. Yet it counts among the vast set of federal aid that President Trump is trying to eliminate as he scrounges for ways to cut costs at home and fund a larger, more expensive military. Mr. Trump has eyed a series of potentially unpopular and divisive domestic spending cuts for the next fiscal year in a move that may test the political appetite and financial health of a cost-weary American public. Even as voters grow frustrated with the economy and seem eager to exact their revenge of the ballot box, the president has proposed to scale back some of the very federal programs that are meant to ease families' toughest financial burdens. So to boost the military budget, the president is targeting some of the most popular programs at home. He wants to scale them back. And those programs, the ones that he wants to scale back, are meant to ease families' financial burdens. That from the New York Times. Jackie.
It's not really surprising, to be honest. From the perspective of someone on the outside looking in, it looks like this self-proclaimed peace president is gearing up for more war and has to find a way to pay for it. As far as how they're taking away from, you know, for example, health programs, this has hits in two ways. So we have a very healthy population, and baby boomers such as the president are living longer because they've had better nutrition, they've had better health care since prior generations. And then also the research funding to combat diseases that we have been working on, and new diseases such as COVID, people are living longer. And so, you know, this hurts in that way. But also, I just want to talk about the idea that we have a systematic way of treating women and mothers that I think is detrimental to us as a whole, as far as Americans go. So, you know, we have, the claim is to be pro-family, but then there are policies, or rather a lack of policies, that support families and children when it's most needed. So, you know, we have excellent schools in this country. But if you look at a list of the nations that produce the most scientists, the United States is not number one. In fact, there are other nations per capita that produce more scientists than the United States. And we're actually number 18. And part of that, I think, is because our family leave policies are not enabling the opportunities for parents to stay home with their children at very crucial times. So, you know, in other countries, you know, women have, you know, 3, 6, 9 months off. And, you know, research has shown that that time is good for bonding with a child. And also they're able to breastfeed, which is much harder to do, as any mother could tell you, when they go back to work. And this is much more valuable for brain development than infant formula when you have breast milk. So this first 5 years is really, really crucial. And then also the average American woman only takes like 10 and a quarter week off or something like that before they have to go back to work immediately. So it shortens the time that they spend. And then the issue of daycare is, you know, just kind of in flux rather than knowing that the child is going someplace where they're going to be engaged and enriched and they're going to be developed. You know, family members are pitching in to do it. So I was on a train back from New York, not the same train you were on.
No.
And there was a grandmother. There was a grandmother there. She was a cancer patient, and she was completely bald, and she was with her 2-year-old granddaughter coming back from a doctor's appointment. And I'm assuming she had to pitch in and watch her child's daughter, but meanwhile she has her own health issues as a grandparent, and she's going around with the grandchildren to the doctor's appointment. Basically, there's all of this ad hoc piecing, mealing together, and every family is kind of left to their own devices for how they're going to cover daycare and costs, and every company is different. And it's just a mess. And so I feel like the idea that, you know, well, you know, we're just not going to handle daycare, and that is not promoting us being as good as we can at research, at science, and at healthcare.
I have to get better at talking to people who I'm on the train with, because I never do that.
I go into my little bubble. I wish I could have a quiet car at work. I do love quiet cars.
Yes.
I appreciate your comments. I think Russ Vogt is committing treason. I think the Heritage Foundation is a terrorist, intellectual terrorist organization. I think their plans for dismantling the country are coming to fruition. There's a lot of words there, Bob. But this is part of the plan. Part of the plan was to destroy the federal government apparatus. Jackie makes some really interesting comments about researchers, but let's link this to a couple of other really bad policies. What we have done to international students who in the past would have come to study here, many of whom would have stayed, many of whom then would have set up the very companies that RPI was being recognized for doing. This has driven innovation and economic booms that other countries have been envious of, and they killed it. Mm-hmm. Okay, they killed it with the fact that it's damn near impossible for international students to get visas the way they did, which means that they are the best and the brightest are not coming here. You pair that on with the fact that the idea somehow that there never seems to be enough money for us the people, but there's plenty of money for tax breaks for the rich, mm-hmm. for corporations, for corporate givebacks, for the military industrial complex. I'm sorry, if we as a nation said, listen, We're going to take on. We're actually going to go to war, but it's going to be a war on cancer. We could do something that could benefit the human race and certainly our own people, and we don't do it. But what we do is that we pit the very poorest and say that if someone who has been born poor is somehow criminal because of the way they were born, mm-hmm. or somehow if you're fortunate enough to be born into the Epstein class of aristocracy that we have developed, that you are somehow gifted with intelligence. This country is in tough shape right now, and it needs to change. It needs to change at the ballot box. It needs to change at the law. It needs to change in our tax code, and it needs to change in congressional guidance about what are the priorities of this country. it's grim, Joe. And for the for the letter writer who's still under my skin about saying I wasn't angry enough, I am plenty angry. I just can't say some of the words I'd like to on air. And I'm angry at you for writing that,
yeah,
just to let you know. So everybody at work who's like, oh, God, he's coming back.
It's a little Thorazine for Bob.
Which I can't afford anymore because it's too expensive. Thank you. Thank you, Trump.
You know, this whole thing, though, of with the president saying about we can't afford daycare, we can't afford all these things, and it's on to the states. Okay, but what do we? But how does that?
But Joe, this jackrabbit's talking about golden arches in ballrooms, and he's golfing every weekend on the taxpayer money. I'm sorry, this is so morally bankrupt. This administration is so morally bankrupt. It's disgraceful.
100% agree.
I agree with you too. I don't think there is one of the 50 states and commonwealths in this country that you would talk to and say, "Oh, we have extra money for that." I mean, that's just not the way it's set up.
No.
I mean, right. The programs that they have now, I mean, is there waste? Are they doing all they can do? I don't know. I mean, sure. I assume there are things that can be changed. But to say to a cash-strapped county that you now have to do this, just seems to not to even, I mean, beyond not feasible.
Yeah. And when everything diverts back to what's the profit margin? I mean, and again, we need the federal government. I mean, I firmly believe that there should be expectations of service delivery as an American citizen wherever you are at. You know, you have the right to expect clean drinking water. That you should have the right to expect to be able to get medical care. You should have the right to be able to have basic infrastructure. And we have allowed this administration to walk away from a lot of our responsibilities. And again, this is not just the executive level. This is also our legislative branch, who has failed us tremendously in their responsibilities to budgeting and making hard decisions.
All right. Bob has proven that he is mad and bitter. So that's the way we've...
In case you were wondering.
Despite that letter that Bob wasn't mad enough. All right. Mission accomplished. I want to thank all of you for being with us this morning. Thanks to John Faso, Bob, and Jackie. It's always lovely to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us. A very important discussion, and I thank you for being a part of
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having me.
Panel at WAMC.org, and we always love hearing from you, and we'll do this again tomorrow morning. We still have another hour of the show. We'll tell you all about it coming up.